Hello, and welcome to Physics Frontiers number 51, Gravitational Wave Astronomy. Show notes for this episode can be found at frontiers.physicsfm.com/51. Show notes include the papers we read for this podcast, as well as links to related episodes and other suggested reading. So, Randy, what's going on?
Good to hear from you, Jim. Today we're going to talk about a really exciting topic that I just absolutely love and is truly a new frontier in physics and astronomy.
A new frontier in physics and astronomy. Okay, what are we talking about today?
Gravitational wave astronomy. This is the field of research which has been theoretically and kind of observationally developing for decades, but now with our first direct detection of gravitational waves at the LIGO facilities, we're up and running. So we're in a new frontier where we can learn things that we could never have learned before, and we can probe into regions of space and time that we could never have gotten data, direct data from before. And you know, I was thinking about this when Sabine Hossenfelder did a YouTube video where she was talking about how she doesn't really think that building a bigger particle collider than the LHC is really such a great idea. And she said where we can really learn things that are new and help physics progress is in the realm of astronomy by studying dark energy and dark matter. And this gravitational wave astronomy is exactly the kind of tool that we need in order to, I think, get the observational data and move theoretical physics forward, because the universe is kind of perplexing us at these scales, and I think we're going to learn a lot more by looking outward than we are by looking at particle collisions right now.
Well, yeah, there's a lot of things that you can learn about this. What particular things were you thinking that we could learn?
Well, one of the first things that started to come out in the popular press when they detected gravitational waves from the collisions of black holes and so forth, and they've had a lot of detections. I didn't realize, like, it's been rapidly advancing over the last year or two.
They had maybe a dozen detections from Advanced LIGO and Virgo, I think, in 2015, 2017. And then in the past year, LIGO's come back online, and they've had around 65 or 70 in the past year.
That's right. There's a Wikipedia list of gravitational wave observations, and it just goes on, and you're like, oh my God, they've been really busy the last year and so. Holy smokes.
I mean, this is still March when we've done this, and they came online last April, and so it's around six a month or so.
Yeah, so that is just a burgeoning area of research that's making huge progress already. And even in the first articles that emerged when they detected the first gravitational wave collision, like gravitational waves from a collision of astronomical bodies, they were talking about how you can actually, based on analyzing the signal, like if you have a high enough resolution with your detector, then you can sort of tease out what's going on inside the event horizon of a black hole as it's merging with another massive body, right? So we can start learning things about the dynamics within the event horizon for the first time, because gravitational waves can tell you about what's happening inside and how the masses are exactly colliding with each other. And in the coming years, when they start getting the LISA, the space antenna, online, then we'll be able to probe the low-frequency gravitational wave realm, and we can even start getting data from, you know, even way earlier than that. They're saying that we could get data about what was happening with the Big Bang at moments like within 10 to the minus 24th second. So this is a great advancement that's throwing open doors that most of us had never even considered to be possible. Like if we could actually model the evolution of the era of cosmic inflation, for example. You know, maybe theoretically we will eventually come up with an equation that shows us why this accelerating expansion happens in the first place.
I think those are some of the goals in the long term.
Right, and this seems like a great way to get there.
So a lot of things can be happening with the gravitational waves, and they were first detected only about 5 years ago. I guess we should say, like usual, we're looking at a particular paper that was written much earlier than that, right, in 1999-2000 timeframe, which is Gravitational Wave Astronomy by Bernard Schultz, who's written a couple of books on gravitation, one on general relativity, as well as one on just gravitation in general, I think called Gravity from the Ground Up, which is a lot more accessible. He's obviously a big guy in the field. So he wrote this review paper in 1999 telling us what he thought we could expect.
And he was looking into the future. He was like, he looked into the past and gave us a little summary of the kind of gravitational radiation theory that has already been sort of understood with binary stars and so forth. But then he also looked step by step into as our gravitational wave detectors start detecting from their first signals and then the next generation that refines them and so forth and so on. So he was looking into the future, and now we're in that future. And it's wonderful because he had a really clear view of what we could expect and what we could be doing. And we're doing a lot of that stuff right now.
Actually, about 2 years ago, he put together a collection. I don't know what the collection is. I just found the article online, Gravitational Wave Astronomy Delivering the Promises, where he talks about basically seven of those first dozen or so events. So when they measured that, he went through and he talked about what they'd actually learned. He's done a little bit more on that. What I thought was really interesting was there's another paper with the same name by William Press and Kip Thorne from 1972.
Wow.
And the reason why they were doing it then is there was a guy named Weber, I think in Chicago, and he had a bar-type interferometer, and he was claiming to have seen some kind of event, some sort of gravitational wave event. And so they went through all the physics in that in 1972, you know, talking about different kinds of possible detectors and different kinds of possible events, which is more or less the same thing that Schutz did. It was very interesting to find that. Actually, there was another one in the 1980s that I didn't look at, or I didn't recognize the name of the guy who did it, since this other one was by Kip Thorne, and Kip Thorne is one of the guys who got the Nobel Prize when they discovered the gravitational waves, because he was, you know, one of the three people important in LIGO. I decided to pick that up and give it a look, too.
How does it compare? Because I found this paper to be pretty supremely well-written and comprehensible. I think Schutz did a great job of summarizing the field. I mean, it's like 29 pages, including the references. So it's not a very long paper, but he did cover a lot of territory in the broad strokes of what we're talking about. And anybody can find this paper. Just go to Google Scholar and look up Schutz, Gravitational Wave Astronomy, and you'll find it on the archive for free.
I guess first, they'll find it on the show notes, because we always put these in the show notes. Let me see if I can guess what the URL will be. It should be frontiers.physicsfm.com/51. Show notes should be there if you want to look at the papers. We put all the papers that we talk about online. As far as how they compare, I mean, they're reasonably similar. They talk about the same physics. The Kip Thorne one is a little bit longer, has a little more math in it. It doesn't have a lot of really exceptional math, so it's something you can actually read. It's something you can read and just skip the equations if the equations bother you, and it should be okay. Which is the same, really, for Schutz. Schutz does have a few equations in there, but they're not really equations that will hurt your brain.
Yeah, it's not pages of derivations. It's just like, here's a formula that we use for estimating something.
I mean, they talk about more or less the same things. You know, a lot of this stuff was a lot more theoretical in 1972. I mean, they did have those bar detectors in place at the time. And I mean, there are a couple of places in Italy where they do have bar detectors as well. But the interferometer detectors are the big thing. But both of them talk about both of those kinds of detectors. I don't think at that time they were thinking about something like LISA, where you put three different satellites in the same orbit as the Earth around the sun, you know, making a giant equilateral triangle and bouncing light off of them to try to figure out stuff about gravitational waves.
Wait, are you saying that the LISA experiment will have, like, three different satellites that, like, a triangulated at the Earth's orbit around the sun, so it'll basically be, like, an Earth orbit-sized detector?
That's what I have here in my notes. Expected 2034 by the ESA.
I wasn't sure if those three satellites were going to be in the orbit around the Earth or in the Earth's orbit around the sun. And I was kind of intrigued because you could build this thing as big as the whole solar system if you wanted. You know, you could go way out to, like, Pluto.
Yeah, they said it was the same as the Earth's orbit, about 20 degrees behind the Earth for one of them, and the other one's on a big equilateral triangle. That should give a much better signal-to-noise ratio.
And you'll be able to see into the much lower frequency of gravitational waves where you can look into, like, you know, before the surface of last scattering. I think that's like 300,000 years after the Big Bang. We'll be able to see beyond that veil, I think, and to discern information, right?
Yeah, they can look into that. They can see machos, if machos exist. at all these other things that you could possibly see, right? So these Earth-based detectors, at least so far, can only look at three kinds of events, basically, right?
Mergers.
Actually, they're all mergers, right? They're black hole mergers, which is the most common one. Neutron star mergers and black hole neutron star mergers. I mean, those are basically what they can see.
And because those are all high frequency events, right?
Yeah, because those are all greater than 1 hertz, I think. So yeah, they can see those. You can't see like a man-made source or anything like that. So now it is interesting that in that first set of data, they only saw one event with the neutron star merger. They were able to see the gamma ray signal optically about 2 seconds after they got the gravitational signal. So that is really interesting. That actually puts a limit on the speed of gravity. Somebody else went ahead and did all the math on that. That was Neil Cornish. I think he's in Montana. It's weird. He has these huge error bars, right? Now, this is the first time we've been able to constrain the speed of gravity. And the speed of gravity has to be in between like half the speed of light and 1.5 times the speed of light.
It's a pretty big error bar.
Yeah. Maybe it's a little bit smaller. Maybe it's 0.55 the speed of light and 1.43 times the speed of light.
Right.
Although we have a pretty good idea that the speed of gravity has to be the speed of light, because at least in general relativity, if the speed of gravity is different from that, then, you know, the solar system ended up being unstable. That would be bad. But, you know, one of the things we're looking at is if the speed of gravity and the speed of light are different, then general relativity is wrong. So we have to look at one of these modified gravity models. But he was saying that with the two detectors, or maybe even with the third detector, you need another 20 of these neutron star events. And in that past year, there have only been 5, and not all of them seem to have gotten all the data that you'd need to do this. You increase that by a factor of 20, you get down to an error of 20% instead of 100% or 50% or whatever it is.
But I mean, if we're seeing the gamma ray burst optically, and then we're seeing the gravitational waves arrive in such a short span of time of each other, that pretty much just is direct proof that they're, you know, within, you know, a fraction of the speed of light.
Well, they don't actually know the direction that things are coming from. You have to have a perfect model of the merger of those two things to figure out when the bursts show up. Remember, the gravity burst shows up a couple of seconds before the gamma ray burst, and it takes a little bit longer for, you know, the optical burst, maybe as much as an hour longer for the optical burst. So, I mean, it takes a long time for all of these different things to show up. So, which happens when and how much different they should be all depends on your model for that collapse.
But it makes sense, though, that the gravitational collapse would precede an emission of light, right? Because there are processes have to take place for the energy to be released in the form of light, right? I mean, you've got to have fusion reactions and all that kind of stuff happening. So it's like changing its state. So doesn't it take, you know, isn't it reasonable to think there'd be a little bit of lag before we saw the light burst?
Oh, yeah, that's reasonable. Should it only be 2 seconds?
Yeah. Depends on the event, I guess, right?
So you have to have better models for that, and actually probably need to have a good idea about the position and the actual distance. So that event was supposed to be 40 megaparsecs, you know, plus or minus 8. Or 125 million light years away, excuse me. 125 million years ago, plus or minus 12 million years. It's still a pretty narrow range, probably, no matter what your model. But still, you need to have a good idea about what's going on there. You have to have a good idea about the tilt and where exactly the thing is coming from in the sky. One thing he said, though, was if you had the other two detectors come online, one is in Japan, Kagra, which is actually online about a month ago as we talk about this. It came online 25 February. That's in Gifu, Japan. And the other one is LIGO, India, which will come online in 2024 because they wanted to have a similar detector as far away as possible. First, they tried to do it in Australia, right? You know, Perth is a perfect place, for example, because there's nothing for 1,000 miles around Perth, basically. Western Australia is what would happen if there was no Las Vegas in Nevada, right? But, you know, Western Australia is a great place for it. So you could put it in Perth, or maybe you could put it in Adelaide. They were going to try to put it in Perth.
Are you saying that it's a great place because there's a low noise in terms of, like, industrial things happening and all that stuff?
I'm just guessing that that's the reason why they put it there. But I'd expect so. I mean, you don't want it to be, you know, you don't want to put them in New York City. Although I guess when they wanted to build LIGO originally, they wanted to build one in Los Angeles and one in Boston.
Right, keep it close to the universities and, you know, all the fun places you want to go.
Well, I mean, the people who wrote the grant were at Caltech and MIT, so.
Right. They want to be able to walk out of their office and go down to the gravitational lab.
Well, yeah, I mean, it might not be, you know, right there. It might be, you know, out in the country somewhere, but at least they'd want to be able to go there without having to buy a plane ticket.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, spend one day a week there and then, spend a couple of days a week there and then a couple of days on campus or, you know, something like that, rather than have it be, you know, as far away as possible from both places and still stay in the U.S., I assume you still wouldn't want to put one of these on Hollywood Boulevard, right? You probably wouldn't want to have one of these, crap, I forgot the name of the one street I knew in Boston.
I guess it's been too long. Yeah, because every time the muscle car with a great stereo system goes by, you're going to get a little vibration in your detectors, right?
Yeah, well, probably not. So according to this, there's no way we're going to be able to produce a gravitational wave, right?
Well, no, but when the soil shakes, whenever there's any kind of seismic activity, it can mess with the noise level of the detectors, you know? I always feel bad for the guys out here in Louisiana. They have the LIGO facility in Livingston, Louisiana, which is in the middle of freaking nowhere. And I just keep thinking, like these super genius eggheads out there in the middle of the Louisiana countryside dealing with all the locals, and they must seem like aliens out there.
I think it's a perfect place. that's politics, right? You got big money, you have to buy the votes somehow. So, yeah, couldn't get one in Australia, so they're putting one somewhere in India, which is similarly not near anything. It's in the middle of a triangle between Mumbai, Hyderabad, and Indore. I tried to look it up. It didn't look like there was anything that I could conceivably recognize there. But when that comes back up and you have those five detectors, according to whatever I was reading, it sounds like they'd be able to, with only a few detections, get that down to 1% for the error for the speed of gravity.
Sweet. Well, I mean, beyond that, I mean, I guess it's just the more detectors you have, the more you can clarify the signal, right? So you can tease more information out of each event you detect, I think, right?
You can get a lot of different information. They'll be coming in at different angles. It might be easier to notice.
Yeah. Yeah, and then the more angles, then the better you can figure out the polarization, so you know exactly the orientation of the system with respect to your observatory and all that stuff.
Yeah, I guess that's another thing, is that with the five detectors, you can constrain the polarization. So right now, they don't really know what's going on with the polarization. They just kind of guess. And, you know, we want to think that we have this cross-polarization, these two cross-polarizations, because it's a quadrupole radiation.
And what do you call those two different forms of polarization? When I'm reading the paper, it looks like a plus sign and a cross product kind of sign. Well, what are those called verbally? Do you know?
I just call them cross and plus.
Okay, fair enough.
Let's see. But with five detectors, you'd be able to tell if there was a vector polarization or a scalar polarization or even a longitudinal polarization. So this is supposed to be a transverse wave, so there shouldn't be any longitudinal polarization in general relativity. If you find any three of those things, that's a violation of general relativity. So, and they also apparently test cosmic censorship, right, which is a postulate by Penrose, I think. Well, was it Penrose or was it Hawking who postulated that?
I can't recall. What was the cosmic censorship hypothesis again?
It says that no naked singularities exist in the universe. So that means for any singularity, there has to be an event horizon.
Well, except in this paper, he mentioned that the Big Bang itself is the only naked singularity we can ever expect to see.
Yeah, but if you improve your detectors, and I'm not sure which one you have to do, probably you have to have the LISA to do this. If there is a naked singularity, then you could see it. Or possibly, if their models are right.
Yeah, I mean, if there's any place where we're going to learn new physics, it's in these extreme regions that have been totally invisible to us until now.
I mean, it is kind of interesting that there are just so many of these black holes out there. And until the 1990s, people didn't really think there would be many at all. I think that's one of the things that I wrote down as one of the hypotheses in here. Yeah, if we have a lot of these small black holes, these black holes that are what they call stellar mass black holes, that are only 10 times the mass of the Earth or something like that, 30 times. If they're all over the place, then they should be very frequently detected. It seems like they're pretty frequently detected now. That's interesting. Actually, I guess it says here in my notes that I was wrong with the Machos. The Machos should have been seen by the first generation detectors, and the first generation detectors didn't see anything.
Yeah, we're not having much luck detecting really any kind of particle to explain the dark matter effect or the dark energy effect, and that just really seems to be pointing in the direction of we need a better understanding of gravitation. You know, like it seems like somewhere along the line, general relativity is going to have a supplementary equation to modify it along the way. I don't know. But it just seems like particles aren't the way that we're going to understand this. Getting this kind of data from astrophysical events seems like the most fertile soil to dig for new physics, you know?
But I think that is one of the things that they think, is that it is possible that with LISA, you might be able to see such high energy events that you could see the low energy effects of quantum gravity. Actually start seeing the deviations from general relativity.
Wow, that's exciting.
But, I mean, people have been looking for deviations from general relativity for a long time. And, I mean, we've looked at this stuff by will, and it looks like every single parameter that you look at, every single thing that they can think of that might change gravity a little bit, once they find a way to test it, it looks like it's general relativity all the way. So, I mean...
But those are all, like, individual events, right? Like, specific star systems and specific types of collisions and all that kind of stuff. It seems like that all works great with general relativity. But at the larger scale, the cosmological scale, we're looking at gravitational effects that we don't have a freaking explanation for.
Some of these effects might just be in, you know, how the different measurements are made. Because, I mean, it just seems like if you have two different ways to measure the Hubble constant, and they both give you different answers, one of your measurements is probably wrong. Or your physics is completely off, right? Which is what people want. But on the other hand, whenever they try to do anything that would fix that, it doesn't really work. It always has some other issue with it.
That's true. We definitely haven't found the right answer yet. But I think if we're going to find answers, it's in this area, you know? Like there's all kinds of new data out there in this realm that we've never even had a chance to look at before. But, you know, when we keep building bigger colliders, like Sabine Hossenfelder was saying, it's, you know, like the LHC just really confirmed the standard model. It didn't give us anything new. You know, we haven't seen any new particles at all. And she was saying that you'd need some extravagantly more powerful particle collider in order to start probing, like, Planck energies before we expect to see anything new in particle physics, right? But this is something that's, like, within reach now. Gravitational wave observatories, you know.
So we'll have good as we can get, you know, given that later on we'll make technological improvements, but we'll have the, sort of the infrastructure up for, you know, having terrestrial measurements that are going to be almost as good as we can get as far as the size of the detectors are concerned. Because once we get the one in India and now we've got the one in Japan, we've got almost the entire globe covered. We just still need something in Australia.
And in space. I mean, did you say that LISA goes online in 14 more years?
Well, that's what they say. On the other hand, I think I was looking at some of these papers in here, and they were always off by about 10 or 15 years by when things were going to happen. So, but, I mean, that's when the ESA is thinking of getting LISA online. So NASA dropped out of that one, so that's all Europe.
Ah. God, we're getting trailed on particle physics and now gravitational physics, too. Jesus. But we're still number one in incarceration rate, so that's a good thing.
Well, I mean, right now, we're right on top of the gravitational physics. But, yeah, I mean, LISA will improve significantly over what we've got.
Yeah.
You know, assuming it actually goes through. It is a different region, but they should be able to detect the same things as LIGO. You know, we're also assuming that there will still be a European Union by 2034.
Or a United States, for that matter. I mean, we are in the midst of the apocalypse. All bets are off, man.
Okay.
One of the things that he said in this paper that caught my attention was that, what do you say here? Quasars, X-ray binaries, supernovae, and gamma ray bursts use relativistic gravity to convert mass into energy with efficiencies 10 times or more greater than nuclear reactions can achieve. I mean, that's fascinating. So it's converting mass into gravitational radiation energy, right? 10 times more efficient than nuclear reactions. So I think fusion reactions are like 1,000 times more efficient than fission. And so this is at least 10 times more efficient than that, I guess.
I think that was all talking about the reasons why we already know in 1999 that gravitational radiation is so important.
Yeah, because they modeled all kinds of things with that quadrupole map, right?
Yeah, so we could already see through our observations things that required gravitational radiation to be happening through whatever they were, the cataclysmic variables, binary neutron star systems, and young neutron stars. And so that's what all those things were saying, is that, you know, you need something more efficient than nuclear reactions to make these neutron stars
lose the enormous amount of mass they had to be losing during those events, right?
It carries angular momentum out of the system as they're driving together in the novae. I think the people who do the work call it novae. Well, they don't actually say that. They say sneeze. Supernova events. Sneeze.
In this paper, was he using like the parameterized post-Newtonian equations to model some of these effects? These didn't look like the fully nonlinear tensor field equations that you sometimes see.
I mean, he was using the quadrupole approximation, and gravitational waves use the quadrupole approximation. They're so small, even when you have a reasonably high amplitude as far as they're concerned, that you don't need to use the full equations. You can just do that first linear approximation. But that's not the parameterized post-Newtonian system. So the parameterized post-Newtonian system is a way to put parameters in there that will categorize all the different theories of gravity so that you can compare experiments and see which categories of gravitational theory are still viable given the experiments and the observations that we've seen.
Oh, okay. I was getting that mixed up with the linearized approximation of gravity that we saw with like Robert Forward.
Well, this is approximated at some level. They're just going down to the quadrupole term in that expansion.
And so they're ignoring the octupole terms and all those other ones that like go on forever.
Yeah, you're just looking at the lowest order term that actually produces the gravitational radiation, because since it's small, right? I mean, if you look at LIGO, the vibe change in the length of that path that the photon's bouncing about in that giant Michelson interferometer is about 1/10 the size of a proton, right? And the arm length, I should have looked this up. I think it's 4 kilometers. And the change in that length is smaller than a proton. It's super tiny. That's the size of your gravitational wave, right? So if that's the size of the quadrupole radiation, then how small is the octupole radiation?
Right, yeah. Orders of magnitude smaller than that, I guess, huh? Wait here. I was just looking at the LIGO on Wikipedia, and it's saying here that you're right. It was 4 kilometer mirror spacing of less than 10,000th the charge diameter of a proton that they can detect. Ooh, less than 10,000th of the charge diameter of a proton. Now, I guess the charge diameter is probably much larger than the actual radius. So, yeah, it says charge diameter. I wish they would have put that in terms of an actual, you know, radius like this. I guess it's like a root mean square radius or something that they usually use for the proton, but it's like a very, very specific finite number.
Yeah, so you generally think of the nucleus of an atom as about 1 femtometer. It's not big.
God, that's amazing. And they keep making upgrades. They got like an extra order of magnitude, I think, back in 2014 or 2015 when they made their first detections. And then they've made, I guess, additional upgrades since. It's like optics. God, the science of optics is just making leaps and bounds forward.
Yeah, one of the things they do for that, that's still a pretty small arm. So what they do is they bounce the light in there. It's a Fabry-Perot interferometer on top of a Michelson interferometer. So they bounce the light back and forth like 100 times to make a larger effective arm length. So the effective arm length for that light as it bounces back and forth is more like you know, 400 kilometers or something like that.
Cool. Yeah, I think that paper that we talked about, did we talk about that paper about detecting a gravitational field in the lab where you had like a pair of Helmholtz coils and then you had an interferometer? And they were talking about bouncing the light back and forth between that region of warp space-time for like months. So, you know, I guess you can amplify the sensitivity of your detectors, but I mean, it blows my mind to think that you could keep like specific photons bouncing back and forth between mirrors for that much time. But I guess maybe that's within reach. All right. So let's see. What else was in this paper that we really enjoyed finding here? Let's see. He did give a list of different regions that we could start looking into. A lot of it's just, you know, the fine art of astronomy, getting a better understanding of certain types of neutron stars and X-ray binaries and all that stuff.
Well, I mean, we can look at some of the titles in here. What was the fun one? Relic Gravitational Waves from Cosmic Strings, Updated Constraints and Opportunities for Detection, for example. So that, I think, was the one where Schütz was talking about detecting the Big Bang. Seen another one in here. I guess it is Schütz again. Or Schütz. Schütz again. And he says that you should be able to see the weak scalar component of gravity that comes in unified field theories, if it exists. You know, the scalar tensor gravity is not highly likely based on that parameterized post-Newtonian framework, but gravity is a particle, I guess. It should have a weak scalar component somewhere, at least according to this. He apparently didn't have a reference for me, because I don't have a reference next to that, because that looks like something I'd want to read. So those are a couple of things that have to do with, you know, string theory, unified field theories in general. Lots of talk about noise.
Yeah, that's where the Weber bar really looked like a long reach to me, because he was saying that for the amount of length change in a Weber bar to be, you know, from a gravitational wave that you could expect, it was in the same order of magnitude as the quantum noise. And it's like, well, holy crap, how do you tease a signal out of that?
Yeah, but I mean, Weber thought he'd seen something till he died. Now, Weber was also doing this at room temperature, which is almost insane. But, you know, the two things in Italy, one in Rome and one in Padua, called Nautilus and Auriga, are millikelvin temperatures. So that's a little bit better. But from the zero-point fluctuations, the zero-point vibrations are supposed to be so large that you shouldn't be able to see anything. Unless, he was saying, you use squeezing to move the noise into the conjugate variable. And that sounds really tricky with a giant bar of iron or whatever it is that they're using.
Yeah, I've seen talk about the squeezed light states, but I've never seen anybody talking about squeezed, like squeezing a whole bar.
Yeah, you don't have to squeeze the bar, you just have to squeeze the photons. Or the phonons, excuse me. So
the phonons in the bar.
I'm sure. I'm not sure, but that's okay.
No, I think you were right. I remember we were talking about the phonons in the bar, and that's still, you know, I don't know how that would be done. I guess nobody's figured it out, because it hasn't been built.
Yeah, they haven't figured out how to do that in those Italian detectors.
I think we covered all the highlights of this paper so far. I look forward to seeing more papers analyze like these 50 or 60 different signals that they've gotten so far and see what they're learning. I'd love to see what the resolution's looking like of the signal, because apparently the clearer you can model that gravitational wave signal, the more you can figure out about what's going on in invisible realms optically, you know.
I just want to see if I put any notes in my Kip Thorne paper to see any strange predictions he may have made or something like that. No, I didn't make any notes. Oh, I made some notes, but I didn't make any notes that said, you know, by 1980, we should be surfing on the gravitational waves or anything like that.
You know, I wonder, you were saying that there was a 2-second delay between the gravitational waves arriving and the light that we could see, the gamma ray burst. Boy, you know, I wonder if that would be enough time to set up some kind of like automated astronomical system so that you could rotate your telescope to that point in the sky once this gravitational wave signal arrives, so that you could make sure that you could get all of the optical data that you wanted from that event?
I mean, apparently they weren't able to get the data on one because the place where you could see it optically would have to look through the sun or something like that. So that doesn't work very well.
Oh, crap. Yeah. Well, hopefully that won't happen too often.
The gravitational waves just waltz through the sun, but the electromagnetic waves seem to have a problem with it.
You know, one of the things that hadn't occurred to me until I saw it in this paper was they're saying the gravitational waves get gravitationally lensed. We know the gravitational lensing of light, and we've learned tons of stuff using that. But what more can we learn with the gravitational lensing of gravity waves? That would be really interesting to think about.
I mean, I've looked at some of the data, unfortunately. You know, I just wonder how they're able to tease much information out of that. It doesn't look like it's the cleanest signal. Of course, they're going to make it better and better and better. So, but still, sometimes on these things, it's amazing that they can claim they've seen something. But on the other hand, if you see something 1.7 seconds before something so that somebody else can actually start pointing things at other places, then yeah, probably it's real. But it's amazing that, you know, with the counts on that thing, that, you know, their modeling was as useful as it was.
Yeah, I wonder if these events will happen like behind a galactic nucleus or something, so that we can start seeing the first detection of gravitational lensing of gravitational radiation. I guess that's probably improbable for, you know, one of these events to happen directly behind a source of extremely high gravity, but it'll happen eventually, right?
Well, I would say that it's highly likely that there are these events happening a place where you have a large source of gravity, right? You have these supermassive black holes sitting in the middle of galaxies, right? Probably it's likely that that'll happen, but you have to have some kind of knowledge of where the thing is supposed to be in the first place, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's, to see the shift, you'd have to know where it was.
If you're looking at continuous events, it's easy, right? If you see a star and then it gets close to Jupiter and then you measure this little shift, it's simple. But if you have these discrete events and there are these black holes that are sitting out in the middle of nowhere that you can't see until they actually hit each other, then how can you tell whether or not they've lensed? Now, maybe you can. Maybe you can by, you know, redshift or something like that.
Polarization change, maybe, right?
Now, some of the events that you should be able to see with LISA are continuous events.
Yeah, like orbits and stuff.
You know, rather than two black holes merging, two black holes spinning around each other, that's supposed to be a maximally asymmetric event, and it's continuous. If you can actually see something over nearby a galactic center in the sky, then you just watch it and see what happens.
So you said that's an ESA project, right? The whole LISA thing?
Yeah, I think NASA dropped out in 2010, 2011, and I think that did push it back. Maybe they've got a better idea.
Come on.
To be honest, if you're just thinking about it, you probably want to have a second detector.
Yeah.
And probably have it in a different orbit as well, but you definitely want to have it in an orbit that's not in the same plane as the Earth.
So it'd be nice to have another one that, like, 90 degrees, cover both all axes. Now we're talking.
Okay, well, now all you have to do is write the grant and see what happens.
see the congressman in the United States. Wait, has this physics thing really been proven? Come on. Isn't this all just God's will?
If they have to come to a meeting every year in New Orleans in February, they'll be happy.
Well, they won't be happy right now.
All right, well, it sounds good. You have a great time, Randy. Thanks for talking.
Thank you, Jim. It's always good to hear from you.
All right. Bye now.
Bye.
You have just listened to Physics Frontiers episode number 51, Gravitational Wave Astronomy. Show notes for this episode can be found at frontiers.physicsfm.com/51. Show notes include the papers we read for this podcast, as well as links to related episodes and suggested reading. Thank you.